Hello and good evening. It's wonderful to see you all here. My name is Ellen Hickey. I'm with the Pesticide Action Network and PAN. And PAN and Food First would like to welcome you all here to what should prove to be an interesting, stimulating discussion this evening. Our co-sponsors for this evening are the University of Berkeley Institute for International Studies and California State University, Sacramento. You may have noticed, Environmental Studies Department, you may have noticed that there's papers on your seats. Those are so you can write down questions as the evening goes on, and there'll be opportunities when volunteers will pick up the questions and bring them up to the stage later in the evening. So now I'd like to introduce our moderator, Mark Hertzgaard. He's an independent journalist and author whose work has been translated into 12 languages. His most recent books are The Eagle's Shadow, Why America Fascinates and Infuriates the World, and Earth Odyssey, Around the World in Search of Our Environmental Future. His work has been widely published in the national media, and he is a regular contributor to National Public Radio. May I introduce Mr. Hertzgaard.
Good evening. Very nice to see you all here in this wonderful theater here in Sacramento, the Crest Theater. Can you hear me all right there in the back? How about that? You know, maybe we're going to just... All right. Is the mic on there? And that's a little bit better. Thank you. How about in the back now? Can you hear all right? All right. Very good. So thank you all for coming to this very important debate, one of the few events here at the conference that is actually open to the public. We are very... I'm very pleased to be here. I want to remind you all as we start that this evening is being taped both by radio and television for subsequent broadcast. We are not live, but it will be played later on a number of different stations, KBOO in Portland, Oregon, KPFA in Berkeley, California, and KVMR in Nevada City as well. And I believe also the local, it is. Well, hello to KVMR in Nevada City. We are with you live. And I believe as well we are joined by the local cable access television channel here in Sacramento. Welcome to you. I'll be introducing our panel here in a minute. We have an excellent panel from all sides of this very complex and important issue. I must say, as a reporter who's been covering environmental issues for many years now, this whole debate around biotechnology is one that reminds me very much of the debate around nuclear technology that happened 20 years ago, in particular here in the United States, in the sense that each of these technologies has such enormous power for good and ill. And each of these technologies, in a sense, touches the finger of God, where you are, as humans, we are getting to, in the case of the nuclear technology, learning how to split atoms, the actual energy force that puts life on this planet through keeping the sun working. And in the case of biotechnology, really changing and affecting the way that crops are grown here on Earth. So in both of these cases, nuclear and biotechnology, the passions run very high because the stakes are so high. With that in mind, I'm going to ask everyone here to show respect, especially for those points of view that you don't necessarily think that you agree with. I must say, as a reporter, I'm always... struck by how I usually find that I learn so much more from the people that I thought I disagreed with. And I think that's a good watchword for tonight. So, with no further ado, accept one personal request, please, any of you who have cell phones. Now is the time to put them out of our misery. Please turn off your cell phones, and I will, in fact, introduce everyone at one go here, and then we will all be speaking. The evening will work like this. Each of the six panelists will have a brief presentation of approximately 7 to 8 minutes to begin. After that, there will be a short pause, and you will begin to be able to send questions forward. Look to the sides. There will be people collecting them. And then each of the panelists will have 2 additional minutes to comment on what has come before. And then at that point, we will be opening it up for questions and involve all of you in the discussion as well. So let me begin by the introductions. I don't know if this was designed like this, that the women happen to be on the left and the men on the right. But what I'm going to do, I guess, is introduce in order, coming from my left to my right. That is not exactly the speaking order, but that's the easiest way to do it. On my farthest left, Anuradha Mittal. Ms. Mittal is a native of India and the co-director of one of our sponsors tonight, the Institute for Food and Development Policy, a think tank and education for action center that is committed to establishing food as a human right and to reshaping the global food system to make it more socially just and environmentally sustainable. Next to her is Professor Martina McLaughlin. She is a professor of plant pathology at UC Davis, just down the road here. And she directs, actually, for the entire University of California system, the system-wide biotechnology research and education program for all of the University of California. Prior to taking up this position, she had been the director of the UC system-wide life sciences program and the UC Davis biotechnology program. To my immediate left, Silvia Ribeiro of ETC. Ms. Ribeiro is a researcher and program manager with ETC Group, which is an NGO based in Mexico that works on agriculture and sustainable development. She is originally from Uruguay and has a background as a publisher, journalist, and an environmental campaigner in Uruguay, Brazil, Sweden, and Mexico. How many languages do you speak? 6 languages. Let this be a lesson to us poor impoverished Americans with our single languages. To my immediate right, Mr. Amadou Kanute of Consumers International Zimbabwe. Since May of 2000, Mr. Kanute has been the regional director of a group called Consumers International, which is a global federation of approximately 250 consumer groups from 120 different countries around the world. He heads the regional office for Africa, which is based in his home country, I believe, of Zimbabwe. I'm sorry.
I'm from Senegal.
He is from Senegal. My mistake. And he was very actively involved with his various compatriots there in something called the Lusaka Declaration, issued not long ago, which called for African governments to act in accordance with the precautionary principle on the issue of genetic engineering. Second to my right is Mr. David Hegwood. He is the counsel to the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He was appointed counsel to the Secretary of Agriculture in June of 2001. His responsibilities there include coordinating international trade and biotechnology issues. He's also served as the Assistant Secretary for International Trade with California's Department of Food and Agriculture. He was involved in, as part of the USDA Foreign Agricultural Service, he was extensively involved in the negotiations for the Uruguay Round Agreement of Agriculture on the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, and previously worked under Senator Richard Lugar in the United States Senate. (Clears throat) And finally, to my far right there, Mr. Christian Verschoren. I'm sorry, this is a difficult name. And Dr. Verschoren has been the Director General of CropLife International, which is the plant science industry organization. And he is also a former veterinarian, I learned this evening. And he has been in his current job since June of 2000. For 6 years before that, he was the Secretary General of COMISA, the representative body for the worldwide animal health industry. And thank you all. So with no further ado, let's get started. We are going to begin with Professor McLaughlin. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I do think it's very important that we have these open forums where... Oh, can you not hear me? Sorry. Can you hear me now?
quite close up to your...
So I have to be really close.
There you go.
I've never been accused of not being heard before. I feel a little bit like Serena Williams at the French Open here. Maybe a tennis fan. But as I said, I do think it's very important that we have these open fora where people get a chance to air their views, whatever their position on agriculture technology. I come from a very small farm, a little bit east of here, and across a big piece of water. And I grew up in a semi-organic farm because we didn't have any other choice on the west coast of Ireland. It's pretty difficult to make a living there. And I figured at a very young age that surely there were mechanisms whereby we could employ whatever tools were necessary to improve agricultural productivity while optimizing the quality of life and minimizing impact on the environment. And that's why I went into scientific research. And I haven't changed my opinion about that over time. I have modified it somewhat, but not changed it. I do believe that ag biotechnology is a powerful tool that can be used as part of an integrated system, not on its own. It is not a panacea for all the world's ills. There is a lot of issues of socioeconomic nature and political nature, and among other things, in developing countries. But I do believe, as my friend Florence Wambugu has said, that the advantage of biotech for Africa, she was talking about Africa, is that it is packaged technology in a seed, that you don't have to teach farmers new cultural practices, which they have tried over a long time to introduce and they've never really taken. And she basically said, she was addressing Europe, she said, your issue is what are you going to have for dinner? Our issue is, are we going to have dinner? And that's why a large part of the research that I work with is to help developing countries. One specific project we have is developing better quality cowpeas. Now, the first time I talked to a general audience about this, most people thought I was talking about a bovine excrement. In fact, cowpeas are a very important protein source in West Africa, in areas where people cannot afford other protein sources. But they are a very limited source of nutrition because of huge losses in post-harvest losses. Up to 40% of the harvest is lost in West Africa each year. And one particularly really bad problem is a parasitic weed called Striga that causes $7 billion worth of loss in West Africa. And in Davis, in Professor John Yoder's lab, they've developed a system whereby using a genetic technology, they know what the particular signal is for these plants to act as host to the parasite. And by switching off the signal, you can basically make the plant resistant to the parasite without the use of pesticides, without the use of chemicals. And in fact, if you look as a whole to date, biotech has resulted in the reduction of 46 million pounds of pesticides in the US. That's 46 million pounds less pesticides was used in 2001 to grow crop plants. There was also a 90 to 93% reduction in fumonisin. And you might say, well, what's that? Many people think if something is natural, it's good. But believe me, some of the worst toxins in the world are produced by fungi. And the alternative to not controlling them is in Africa, for example, this leads to liquefaction of horses' brains and liver cancer. Fumonisin is not a good thing to have on your plants, and there is no natural way to control it. Likewise, for farmers, farmers who have shifted to no-till agriculture because of biotech, they've been able to reduce the amount, not just of pesticides, but actually of heavy machinery that's used, because they no longer have to till the surface, so you're not opening up the soil to erosion. You're not using heavy machinery, so you're not using fossil fuels. It's retaining water much better. You're not having runoff. In fact, they now, in the watershed regions of where these crops are grown, they no longer can even trace the atrazine or any of those herbicides that have a water quality advisory. You're also finding the return of small mammals and birds. A friend of mine who's a cotton farmer in Louisiana said, for the first time since she was a child in the 50s, she has heard corncrakes back in the fields again, because, as I said, they're not using chemicals or pesticides, are not plowing. They don't look as pretty. You have a lot of debris, but that is much healthier for the environment. And for farmers themselves, one farmer told me his real advantage to him is less bum time on the tractor, because he doesn't have to spend time mixing complex cocktails of herbicides. He only has to spray if and when weeds come. And in total, they saved $731 million last year. So that means a lot to farmers when they are on the edge. I also think with biotech, there is a real potential to improve food quality. And again, in Africa, this is very important, where you have huge amounts of malnourishment. And the reason I'm saying Africa is that's where I'm most familiar with, because that's where we are, our projects are. But of course, this applies worldwide. And if you look at rice, a huge portion of the world's population is totally dependent on rice, and it's not a perfect food source. It is deficient in many micronutrients. And one I think you probably are all familiar with that has been addressed is vitamin A deficiency, worked by Dr. Petraikis. And I know there's been a lot of criticism, but he succeeded in producing beta-carotene in rice. And he's determined that the amount that you need to offset the pathologies of malnourishment is only 100 grams a day, not the 10 kilograms that I've sometimes heard used. That this is sufficient to offset pathologies, not for optimum health, but to help to reduce the 250,000 children that go blind and be countries each year because of vitamin A deficiency. There is also huge potential for using this for delivering of vaccines in these countries. Again, because you have issues of cold chain, this is keeping a vaccine cold. It's estimated that up to 50% of vaccines that are delivered in these countries are dead because the electricity went off, the power failed, and nobody knew it. But by potentially expressing vaccines in bananas, you can deliver them as a medicine. Now, these would be controlled as medicines. These would not be foods. And this is work Charles Aronson has done. To date, he's expressing cholera and hepatitis B vaccines in potato. And for clinical trials, the poor people had to munch on raw potatoes. And even the Irish don't like eating raw potatoes. But it's worked. They've got actually sterilizing protection against cholera and hepatitis B and Norwalk virus. And so this is a minor method of actually indicating that it works. Of course, the real work is getting it expressed in plants such as banana or tomato that works in these countries. Also, these crops have been more thoroughly tested than any in the history of scientific research. A huge research project was published last year out of the EU, one of the areas that's not exactly probiotic. And they have said that this was a 15-year study looking at 81 projects and 400 labs throughout all 15 countries of the European Union. And from this 15-year study, they determined that not alone are these crops as safe as conventional, but because farmers know exactly what they've done, researchers have a more better understanding of the actual research, better understanding of the traits, and because they're more thoroughly regulated than any crop plant ever, that they're probably safer than any conventional agriculture. We've been modifying crops for a long time, using irradiation mutagenesis. For example, all the spaghetti you eat has been modified using cobalt-60 mutagenesis. Every Asian pear has been modified to make it resistant to black spot. And I think I'm out of time, so I would just finish with what former President Carter said. The real issue in this world is not biotechnology. The issue is starvation, and we should use whatever tool is necessary to address this. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And now we'll hear from Sylvia Ribeiro.
Well, yeah, can you hear me? Is fine? Okay. Well, it was interesting.
Louder.
So? Is that fine?
Yeah.
Okay. It was interesting to hear the vision of biotechnology. I won't speak so much about the vision of biotechnology. I will speak much more about the reality of biotechnology. And the reality of biotechnology today is that there are only five companies in the world. They are Monsanto, DuPont, Syngenta, Bayer, and Dow Chemicals, that owns literally 100% of all the transgenic seeds that are out in the fields today. There are only four crop commodities that are manipulated. It's soybeans, maize, cotton, and canola. There are only three countries, U.S., Canada, and Argentina, that account for 96% of all the transgenic crops in the world. There are only two genetically engineered traits that has been used, and they are not at all related with either vitamins or irons or something like that. It's herbicide tolerant. This is about 77% of the transgenic crops in the field, and it's insecticide plants, that's 50%. The rest is a mix of the both. But these are the only two traits that are really on the fields and are not related by any means with hunger. But there is, in this countdown, from five companies, four commodities, three countries, two traits, there is one fact that we really need to know. That is that Monsanto has 91% of all the seeds that are out, in all the transgenic seeds that are out on the fields. So when we speak about agricultural biotechnology, we could really be speaking about Monsanto. It could be more or less the same. So if we see what is happening with these crops that are out in the fields today, we could take, for instance, the U.S., which is responsible for 66% of the transgenics cultivated in the world today commercially. And it's very interesting to see that the USDA made a report last year called Adoption of Bioengineered Crops. And one of the conclusions said, perhaps the biggest issue raised by these results is how to explain the rapid adoption of GE crops when farm financial impacts appear to be mixed or even negative. So transgenic crops are not doing well in the U.S. Monsanto, which is the main company, is not doing well neither. Monsanto has been showing decreases in sales for the last 3 or 4 years. Last year, 15%. And there is a Dutch consulting firm that made a study about the value of Monsanto as an investor, as to invest in. And it's very interesting because they gave Monsanto the lowest possible rating with the message that agriculture biotechnology is a high-risk industry, not worth investing in. This is for investors. But the interesting fact here is what they say. They said, money flowing from GE companies to politicians, as well as the frequency with which GE companies' employees take jobs with U.S. regulatory agencies and vice versa, creates large bias potential and reduces the ability of investors to rely on safety claims made by the U.S. government. It also helps to clarify why the U.S. government has not taken a precautionary approach to genetic engineering and continues to suppress GE labeling in the face of overwhelming public support for it. With Enron and other financial disasters, the financial community apparently bought into companies' stories without looking much below the surface. This is important to know, not because I have to confess, I'm not very, very worried for Monsanto. But why I'm taking this point is because this may explain why there is such a pressure to sell these crops that are not related to productivity. They are producing less than conventional crops in the case of soybeans, for instance. They are using more chemicals, also in the case of soybeans. And why are they speaking that they are being sold to solve hunger? We in the third world, we certainly don't want to be fed by pesticides. We prefer food in general. So what we think is that the pressure of these companies that are doing bad Plus, the situation that many countries don't want to have transgenics is obliging these companies to press upon the third world, upon people that is suffering hunger, these products. These companies are not only having a control of the market through this incredible monopoly that has not any comparison in the industrial history of the world. One company, 91% in the world. It has never happened. So besides this, Monsanto also has a world patent for soybeans. It's a species patent that Monsanto challenged when it was registered, but then both the company that had the patent and said, it's okay with the patent now when we have it. So this is not about visions on biotechnology. This is about realities. There is another thing that is in the pipeline. It's not a market reality, but we are really afraid that it's going to become a market reality because USDA announced that it's going to be receiving applications for commercialization from this year, which is Terminator technology. Terminator technology, in addition to controlling markets, and then the rest of the world by patents, they also want to be sure that there is a technical, a biological fixes that prevent farmers from saving their own seeds. And this is Terminator technology. It's a suicide technology developed by the USDA together with a company called Delta Pipeline that was owned by Monsanto when they made the announcement on Terminator. If you ask me, why we insist in that this is bad, I will say one thing. 500 companies in the world, they are the largest 500 transnational companies. They give work to 1.59 of the people that works in the world, while peasants have 25% of the world population are peasants, smallholder farmers that give food to themselves and to their families, which is much more than half of the population. There is also another aspect. I want to finish quoting an indigenous leader from Mexico called Aldo González. He's from the region where they discovered that transgenic maize has contaminated local varieties, native varieties. And he says like this, he says, seeds are a central element of our lives and our culture. The pyramids might one day disappear. They could even be destroyed. But a handful of seeds of maize contain the inheritance that we leave our children and our grandchildren. Yet today, they want to deny us the ability to do that. We're speaking of 10,000 years of culture, and our seed has proven to be safe for that many years. Today, they tell us that transgenic seeds are safe, but what proof can they offer us? 5 or 6 years of use is nothing. It does not prove they are safe. For our own seeds, we do have proof that they are safe. 10,000 years of use. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll now hear from David Hegwood of the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Thank you. Before I came down here tonight, several people said, gee, you must do this a lot. The fact is, there aren't very many opportunities to do this, and I really want to thank the organizers for putting this forum together. I think it's obvious already tonight that this is an issue that stirs intense debate, intense emotion, and I think it's worthy of much more debate of this kind, and so I'm happy to participate in this program. And what I want to do tonight is just explain from my perspective why it's so critical to use every tool we have, including technology, to address the problem of hunger and poverty in the developing world. That's the issue that we're discussing down the street at the ministerial conference. Why do we need the technology? 800 million people in the world, that's one in every seven people, suffers from chronic hunger. Hunger hits children hardest. One in three is malnourished. And every 5 seconds, a child dies from hunger or malnutrition. The challenge of ending hunger gets bigger every day. Over the next 15 to 20 years, the world population is going to increase by over 1 billion people. The majority of that growth will occur in regions that are already food insecure. Cereal yields will have to increase by 40% just to keep pace. But yield increases in most developing regions are beginning to slow. Hunger and poverty are closely connected. Half the world's population lives on less than $2 a day. About 1 billion of the world's poorest people live in rural areas and depend on agriculture for their livelihoods. In the poorest developing countries, 90% of the food consumed is produced locally. Clearly, by increasing agricultural productivity, we can make great strides in reducing hunger and poverty. A recent study by the International Food Policy Research Institute, a publicly funded institution, suggests that an increase of just 3 to 4% in African crop and livestock productivity would triple per capita incomes and reduce the number of malnourished children in Africa by 40%. A little change can make a big difference. How can biotechnology help? It's a tool, one of many tools we need to use to increase agricultural productivity in the developing world. Biotech crops are already being grown in developing countries, sometimes with dramatic effect. 3/4 of the farmers growing biotech crops are in the developing world. In South Africa, 90% of the cotton farmers, 60% of whom are women, in the KwaZulu-Natal province are planting BT cotton. Since they started growing BT cotton, yields have increased by over 50%. Pesticide applications have been reduced from about 10 sprayings per season to 2. And these are people who spray pesticides by hand. This story of increasing yields and lower pesticide use is playing out in all of the developing countries that are using biotechnology. In the Philippines, where field trials of BT corn have just been completed, researchers experienced yield increases in the range of 40 to 50% and with lower pesticide use. Profits for farmers went up by 12 to 25%. These are real benefits for real farmers in the developing world. Is biotechnology safe? Yes. Okay, we've got 1 point to debate tonight anyway. 3,200 scientists, including 20 Nobel laureates, have signed a petition expressing their belief in the safety of the technology. The National Academies of Science in Brazil, China, India, Mexico, and the United States say it is safe. The Third World Academy of Sciences, the Royal Society of London, the British, French, and American Medical Associations, the World Health Organization, the Vatican, and the European Union have all said the technology can be used safely. You may laugh at the Vatican, but there are a lot of people in the developing world who listen very closely to what they say.
Please let the gentleman speak.
The vast weight of scientific evidence supports the safety of biotechnology. It is a technology that needs to be regulated. There is a consensus on that. And many developing countries need assistance in putting appropriate regulatory structures in place. We're trying to help as the U.S. government, as are many other governments around the world, as is the United Nations Environmental Program and the Global Environmental Fund. The conference being held in Sacramento this week is about finding solutions. There is no single solution to the problem of hunger and poverty. We need to look at all of the potential tools that are available. This is a global problem, that deserves and needs global cooperation among scientists, governments, and civil society. No technological innovation is without risk. But there are two risks here. The first is that we do something, we use biotechnology, and it turns out wrong. So far, there's no basis for that fear. The second risk is that we do nothing. 800 million people, a billion more in 20 years, are going to face starvation. Thank you.
We'll now hear from Amadou Kanute.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, it happens that I come straight after my colleague on my right-hand side, and it also seems that I might have some arguments that might not totally go in the direction that has been taken by my colleague. And for that, I would like first to look at maybe the real reasons why are we being presented as the reason why we need to develop that technology. The very first reason is that the market in America is oversupplied. Production of GM crops has been multiplied in acreage, has been multiplied by 35 over the last 7 years. Second fact, consumption does not seem to follow the same trend. What we are getting is while production is on the rise, consumption is on the decrease. Most of the continents, Latin America, Europe, Asia, have shown a lot of concern about the technology. And today, about 2.5 billion inhabitants are saying we want mandatory labeling. And they are also saying, if we notice that a product has the GE label, we are not ready to buy it. And that's where the problem comes from. Why should you grow things that you cannot sell? It is that contradiction that has put Africa on the map, because Africa, out of the 800 million people who are suffering from hunger, about 200 million are from Africa. So it seems that Africa is being seen as the region where we should be using the technology, promoting the technology on the grounds, on humanitarian, on moral grounds, to say that we want to save people from suffering. Now, how is this being done? That's the second question we need to look at. The development assistance that we have from the U.S. has been pushing GM crops first through food aid. And that has been done in such a way that generally most African government, most consumers in Africa were not aware. It came through the back door through food aid. That has been the first strategy. The second strategy has been to donate seed varieties, patents. We are very concerned about that, because donating patents today, donating seed varieties today, even if the multinationals and the administration is ready to forego the patents now, We don't know for how long. It is just like drugs, giving drugs today. When people get used to it, in 5 years' time, you ask them to pay. The third strategy has been the use of the legal challenge against the EU on the grounds that the EU moratorium is preventing African countries to access technology. And it is taking food out of the people who are hungry. That's the third strategy. What might happen is that the US might win the case at the WTO, but we are very clear that in the end it might boomerang against the US, because it is not states that dictate what is happening on the market. It is the consumers that decide what they want to buy. It is their right to choose. The fourth strategy that has been used to push the technology is what is happening here, the ministerial conference being held behind closed doors, while NGOs such as the one that we represent, who work on a day-to-day basis with the people to ensure that they are food secure, are locked out. Here are the four strategies that have been used. Now, the next question is, will this technology solve the problem of hunger in Africa or anywhere? We think no. And we have some reasons for that. The very first one is to say that this technology is not demand-driven. If it were demand-driven, with 58% of the population on the globe saying, if we were to notice GM label on any product, we won't be buying it, then we won't have had these products on the market. Same thing in Africa. When the Zambian government decided that they wanted non-GM maize as food aid, the only answer we got was, it's either GM maize or starvation. So, what we are saying is, this is not demand-driven, and we live in a free market. A free market wants supply to be to match demand, both in terms of quality, in terms of price, in terms of requirements by the consumers. If the demand does not find what it wants in a product, it's not going to take it. The second reason why we think it is not going to solve the problem of hunger in Africa is that it is not cost-effective. The Striger experience has been given. But there are alternatives to solve the problem of Striger, and they have been tested, and they are given results. But they are not being publicized. They are not getting the support that they need to be able to be used by the people who have been involved in developing it. Another example that the alternative options to the GE are not getting all the support is the rice that has been developed in West Africa, the Nerica rice, the new rices for Africa, which have been developed with involvement of farmers, of the women who toiled to harvest the rice. That rice is giving more yields, and it is from a simple technology by bringing trades from the rice in Asia, bringing trades from the rice in Africa, putting them together, and it is giving better yield, but it is not getting any publicity. It is the GM rice that is getting the publicity. Not cost effective. The third one is that it is not poverty focused. We are talking here of things that only goes for 30% of the producers in Africa. While who are the people who are actually feeding us? It is the 70% of the small-scale farmers who are feeding the population in Africa. Those people don't have the resources, they don't have the technology, they are not involved in developing it, and in the end, the results are not going where it should be going in terms of income generation. So, what we intend to say is that GE is not a problem for Africa. GE is a problem for America. And America wants to turn it into a world program for them. Thank you.